So as Andy said, I've been tasked with discussing central bank independence in retrospect, and in part that's because a little more than two decades ago, Stan Fisher and I wrote about central bank independence in prospect and posed the question, how independent should a central bank be? So when we asked that question in 1994, central bank independence was all the rage. As Andy mentioned, I wrote my PhD dissertation at MIT on it, under Stan's expert tutelage. A bit further up Mass Ave in Cambridge, Adam Posen was writing his PhD dissertation at Harvard on pretty much the same issue. And you'll hear from Adam a bit later on. In New Zealand, the government had established a new framework for independence for the Reserve Bank of New Zealand in 1989, which granted the RBNZ significant independence, including making the governor directly accountable for any failure to achieve the price stability objective. The framework for the ECB had just been established, which legislated a very high degree of central bank independence, more so than pretty much any other central bank in the world. Looking back, that may have been the high watermark for central bank independence, though, of course, the Bank of England's own independence was still to come, so perhaps that was the apogee. So fast forward to today, and central bank independence is no longer quite in the ascendancy as it was 20 years ago. Its legitimacy and effectiveness are under some scrutiny, and as some have argued recently, one can ask the question, is this the end of the era of central bank independence? The answer to that question is no, in my opinion. And the reason why has a lot to do with the answer that Stan and I proposed in answering the question of how independent a central bank should be 20 years ago. I can master this. Maybe not. You won't suffer from not seeing my slides. But, there we go. We made the important distinction between goal and instrument independence, or as it's been relabeled here, operational independence, arguing that central banks should be goal-dependent but have instrument independence or operational independence. That is, the goal that the central bank is pursuing should be determined by the political process, but once given that goal, the central bank should be able to pursue the goal as it sees fit with the appropriate accountability. So that distinction we drew between the two aspects of independence stands up to scrutiny 20 years on, in my opinion. If anything, I would argue that the experience of the past two decades serves to reinforce our conclusion, with the Bank of England's own experience being a prime example, as I'll come to in a bit. So in my remarks today, I will first revisit the motivation for central bank independence. I'll then ask whether those justifications are still relevant today, or is central bank independence a solution to yesterday's problem. I'll then discuss why central bank independence is under more threat today and ask whether modifications to the model of central bank independence are required. So first of all, I'd like to revisit the three foundations of the argument supporting Stan and my conclusion on goal dependence and instrument independence. And the first foundation was the performance of the Bundesbank. So we questioned how effective the Bundesbank had actually been in the sense that recessions were at least as costly in terms of output in Germany than they had been in other countries with arguably less independence. That is, to use the economic term, the sacrifice ratio in Germany was not lower than it was elsewhere, which would have been expected if there had been a material credibility benefit from the Bundesbank independence. Adam actually wrote his thesis on pretty much addressed that issue in his thesis as well. So we cautioned against the cult of central bank independence, that is, the need to avoid excessive concentration on inflation avoidance alone. Hence the conclusion that a central bank should have goal dependence. Second, there was the academic literature. Stan and I noted that much of the academic literature focused on rules versus discretion in the context of dynamic inconsistency. Dynamic inconsistency actually doesn't have any particular implication for central bank independence. A rules-based monetary policy can be implemented mechanically by an agency with neither goal nor instrument independence. They can just do it. Anyway, the argument won out in favour of discretion rather than rules, or at least it has for the moment. If not in all of the theoretical literature, then absolutely in practice. But both in practice and to a large extent in theory, the solution was in the form of constrained discretion. The constraint on discretion is the goal for the central bank set by the government. The central bank then has complete discretion as to how best to achieve that goal. So given discretion, what then is the best institutional framework? Stan and I noted that Ken Rogoff's conservative central banker could be too inflation averse to be socially optimal. The optimal degree of central bank independence was, to quote from what we wrote 20-odd years ago, chosen by trading off the reduction in mean inflation secured by conservatism against the less than optimal trade-off between inflation and output variability produced by that same conservatism. So you could be too conservative and end up with worse welfare outcomes. Carl Walsh took up this point in designing a socially optimal incentive contract for central bank governors, and my mates across the Tasman in New Zealand went a fair way towards actually operationalising it. The third foundation was the empirical evidence of a number of people, including Alex Zuckerman, Alessina and Summers, and these papers showed a very clear negative correlation between average inflation and central bank independence. And this result was quite influential in the changes to central bank independence that occurred around the time of the early to mid-90s. So Stan and I drilled down empirically into what particular aspects of central bank independence underpin this correlation and concluded that inflation and performance is likely to be better if there is gold dependence and instrument independence. Before discussing how these foundations stand up to scrutiny two decades later, I'd just like to spend a bit of time talking about the overlap between central bank independence and inflation targeting. So the issue of gold dependence raises the question about what are the appropriate goals for a central bank. At the same time as central bank independence was coming to the fore, inflation targeting was in its nascence. Indeed, I attended a conference here at the Bank of England in 1995, also organised by Andy, on the then brand new topic of inflation targeting. The New Zealanders had adopted the first formal inflation target in 92, the Canadians and Swedes followed, and the UK itself had just adopted an inflation target. It was noteworthy that the adoption of the inflation target was a couple of years before the Bank of England received its independence. So Andy wasn't quite sure whether to invite us Australians, as we'd just put in place a soft version of inflation targeting around 1993, in marked contrast to the then hair-shirted framework of the New Zealanders and the Canadians. Graciously, he erred on the side of inclusiveness in inviting Glenn Stevens and me to talk about the Australian model, which I'd have to say that model now looks very much like the standard flexible inflation targeting framework that is practiced here in the UK and elsewhere, including both New Zealand and Canada. Anyway, inflation targeting and central bank independence was sometimes conflated, given their similar birth dates in a number of countries. In part, this is because both can be seen as a response to the inflation experience of the 1970s and 80s. And the problem at hand then was how best to establish and maintain a low inflation environment while delivering the desired macro outcomes. But the nature of the underlying issue that the two were intended to address is quite different. The political business cycle was one of the primary motivations for central bank independence. The temptation to run the economy too hot in the lead up to an election argued for the allocation of monetary policy management of the economic cycle to an agency insulated from the political cycle. While one might argue that the political business cycle is less of a consideration today in many countries, its current abeyance should not be assumed to be a permanent state of affairs. Moreover, it is still very much a live issue in a number of emerging market countries. In contrast, inflation targeting arose in part because other monetary frameworks had seemingly proven unable to deliver the appropriate degree of inflation control. As Governor Bowie of the Bank of Canada famously said, "We didn't abandon monetary targets, they abandoned us." In that regard, Mervyn King describes inflation targeting as a coping strategy, coping with the inability of other monetary policy frameworks to deliver the required outcomes. Central banks, in many cases, didn't have a lot of public credibility back in the early 90s in terms of macro policy making. In the Bank of England's case, it wasn't even the monetary policy decision maker. So the institution itself didn't have any track record of monetary policy making. So in the UK, as in New Zealand, Canada and Australia, there was a need to build that track record. So a track record actually requires a track. Inflation targeting provided that track. Here was a goal over which the central bank believes it has a sizable degree of influence. The inflation targeting framework provides a benchmark against which the central bank can be held to account in close to real time. If it's successful, then credibility is likely to build through time. Ultimately, the proof of the central bank pudding is in the central bank independence pudding is in the eating. So, has central bank independence actually delivered? Yeah, there we go. The subsequent two decades have clearly seen low inflation. Somewhat ironically, the problem today is that inflation is too low, which has contributed to the claim that central bank independence, and particularly inflation targeting, is the solution to yesterday's problem. Certainly up until 2007, the low inflation outcomes did not come at the cost of inferior outcomes in terms of output or employment. This was Mervyn's nice decade. But were these nice outcomes causation or correlation? It is difficult to disentangle from other influences, including the emergence of inflation targeting as the operating framework for many central banks. That is, we had central bank independence and inflation targeting landing at the same time. There is also the integration of the Chinese economy into the global economy and the significant disinflationary impulse that came with that. So maybe it was completely unrelated to either central bank independence or inflation targeting. Ed Balls and his co-authors have revisited the empirical findings of Stan and my paper and show that they stand up with the addition of 20 years of data. They demonstrate that the negative correlation remains between the instrument independence of the central bank and low inflation. There is also a strong test case in the recent experience in the UK. So as you remember, the period between around mid-2010 and mid-2012 saw a prolonged period of inflation above target here. Yet inflation expectations remained well anchored, and this was reflected in subdued wage outcomes, leading to a significant decline in real wages. So this event seems to me to demonstrate that the credibility of the Bank of England in terms of inflation control was well entrenched. Could you have conceived of such a conjuncture in earlier periods in the UK, in the 1970s, say? The experience of earlier decades in the UK suggests it's highly likely that inflation expectations would have gone up with inflation. How much can this be attributable to central bank independence or the inflation target is difficult to disentangle. But the fact that the Bank of England had the independence to pursue the inflation target set by the Chancellor must count for something. The fact that the target was not adjusted upward to accommodate the rise in inflation is also consequential. The Bank of England did not have a political incentive to achieve surprise inflation, Barrow Gordon style. So that's the good news. The economic outcomes of the 90s and 2000s in terms of low inflation, low employment and lower economic volatility are at least partly attributable to central bank independence. The political business cycle has been largely absent from discussion for some time. In the end, though, this assessment mostly relies on assertion rather than empirical proof, particularly for the advanced economies. The unknowable counterfactual as what would have happened in a world of less central bank independence remains just that, unknowable. The emerging economies provide a more fertile ground for empirical validation, but China stands as a very large counterexample. But there is also the bad news. Why is central bank independence under threat today? Hang on. In summarising the economic outcomes of the past few decades, I stopped short of the financial crisis and its consequences. Clearly, the output performance since the crisis has been inferior, although labour market outcomes notably less so. Inflation, though, has been low and stable. The UK is obviously not one of those cases where inflation has been too low, given that the average inflation rate over the past decade has been 2.25%, slightly above the middle of the target. How much these outcomes can be attributable to monetary policy settings, both before and after the onset of the financial crisis, is a hotly contested debate, and I'm not going to add to that debate here, but simply note that the unsatisfactory post-crisis growth experience is a significant contributor to the current scrutiny of central banks and their independence. In this regard, I'm concerned that along with insulating the setting of monetary policy from the political business cycle through central bank independence, came a belief that monetary policy was the only game in town for demand management. This belief was reinforced by the success of macro management after the 90s recessions up until 2007. After the onset of the crisis, with a rare exception in 2008-09, demand management continued to be the sole purview of the central bank. Fiscal policy was not much in the mix. And this put additional pressure on central banks. Given their mandate, as long as there was something that could be done to achieve the goals given to them, however small the impact, then that something had to be done by the central bank. Otherwise, there was a serious risk of undermining the legitimacy of the central bank's independence. As we know, that took a number of central banks into the territory of the zero lower bound and beyond. In some respects, monetary policy around the zero lower bound, particularly in the form of quantitative easing, starts to look a hell of a lot like elements of fiscal policy. In the framework that Stan and I use to examine the appropriate degree of central bank independence, government spending or fiscal policy more generally had a central role to play that the central bank needed to take account of. There were different outcomes depending on the nature of the interaction between the central bank and the government, but fiscal policy did play an important role in demand management. Monetary policy was not the only game in town. Central bank independence does not imply the complete delegation of demand management to the central bank. The achievement of the output inflation goals of the central bank is very much a function of the fiscal response too. There is a risk that the cult of central bank independence has placed excessive pressure on the central bank to always do more, to achieve those demand management outcomes. Stan and I examine the issue of instrument independence in a normal macro world where changes in interest rates within his standard historical ranges were sufficient to achieve the desired macro outcomes. Again, that is not the environment that a number of economies have experienced over the past decade, where policy settings have moved into unconventional territory. Unconventional monetary policy has the possibility to undermine the support for instrument independence because of the interaction between the central bank's asset purchases and the government's debt management strategy. Mervyn King noted that inflation targeting as a practical definition of price stability is separable from the understanding of the economy, which can evolve. So I would make the same argument about central bank independence as an overarching framework for monetary policy making. My view is that inflation targeting and central bank independence are being blamed for economic outcomes that are not a consequence of either of them, but rather those outcomes are a consequence of our understanding or misunderstanding of the way that the economy operates. Legitimate criticisms of central banks' understanding of the economy can be made, but that does not delegitimise the overall operating framework. A great strength of central bank independence and inflation targeting is that one's view of the transmission mechanism can evolve over time while the basic architecture of the policy framework remains unchanged. Besides that, a new threat to central bank independence comes from the greater focus currently on the distributional consequences of monetary policy. Monetary policy has always had distributional consequences. The primary transmission of monetary policy decisions is through two relative prices: the interest rate and the exchange rate. The interest rate is the intertemporal price of substitution. That has distributional consequences between savers and investors, always has, as well as across generations, as indeed inflation itself has distributional consequences. The exchange rate has distributional consequences between the traded and non-traded sectors of the economy, as well as cross-border. It is also important to note that unemployment has larger first-order consequences for income distribution, either the interest rate or the exchange rate. But these distributional effects of monetary policy have always been present. Why is it so much more of a threat to central bank independence today? One plausible explanation is the lower level of nominal growth and particularly wage growth. The concerns around income distribution are much starker, though they're not necessarily any less, when nominal wages are stagnant for a significant share of the population. Another possible explanation is that if a primary transmission mechanism of unconventional monetary policy is through asset prices, including house prices, then the wealth channel may be playing a disproportionately larger role today than in the past. And that distributional impact may be much larger than that of other channels of monetary policy transmission. If the distributional impact of monetary policy is larger now than it was in the past, this can compromise the legitimacy of instrument independence. Let me just talk briefly about financial stability and independence to close. So Stan and I also addressed the question about goal independence coming from the standard macro perspective of the day. One aspect that has changed post-crisis is the heightened focus on the financial stability goal of central banks, and the Bank of England is a prime example of this. One question that arises is how the financial stability goal interacts with the inflation target. Is it a separate goal for the central bank that sets up potential trade-offs, or is it aligned with the inflation targeting goal? If it is separate, should the central bank have independence in how it defines the goal of financial stability? Should it have complete instrument independence as to how it pursues that goal of financial stability? The goal of financial stability has generally been left vague. To some extent, it has been defined only in the negative. That is, we can agree that financial stability was not present in 2008, and that wasn't a good state of affairs. But it's much harder to get agreement on what are the important elements of financial stability and how central bank can go about achieving them. The long-lasting and still active debate about whether central bank should lean against the wind is the best example of this. It brings to the fore a number of issues. Is there a trade-off between the inflation target goal and the financial stability goal? Does the goal of financial stability need to be better defined than it is at the moment? If so, by whom? Should the central bank have complete independence to pursue its goal of financial stability with whatever instruments it so chooses, including when the distributional implications of some of those instruments are much starker? The questions do not have a straightforward answer, and I would hope that would be a hot topic for PhD students today in the way that central bank independence was when Adam and I were PhD students in the early 90s. Let me just talk a little bit about accountability. Stan and I were at pains to stress the importance of central bank accountability. It is the very bedrock of central bank independence in a democratic society. It alleviates the criticism that central bank independence is inappropriate because macro policy decisions are being taken by unelected bureaucrats. I find this criticism misplaced. There are many instances where the goals of public policy are being set by the political process, but then are implemented by unelected public servants. That is, the bureaucracy has instrument independence in many different areas, not just central banks. But it does underscore the argument for goal dependence. The central bank is accountable to the political process in achieving the goals given to it. Over the past two decades, accountability has changed substantially. Again, the Bank of England is a good example. There are regular appearances before the Treasury Select Committee. The volume and content of central bank publications is considerably larger and more detailed, and as Mark said, maybe better than it was 20 years ago. The number of speeches is dramatically higher and the messaging more transparent. No longer is it the case that the government would say, if you understood what I said, I must have misspoken. So with independence has come the accountability. The accountability is to the politicians and the population at large, not a small group of central banking aficionados nor the financial markets. This means that unlike the Delphic Oracle, it is important that the utterances of central banks are understandable. Another important distinction in my view between the Delphic Oracle and central banks is that the accountability is confined to the goals given to the central bank. The central bank should not be regarded as a font of all wisdom. To do so risks compromising the independence in the areas that matter. So let me conclude. Central bank independence was in the ascendancy 20 years ago when the Bank of England was given its independence to pursue its inflation targeting goal with complete instrument or operational independence. The framework adopted in the UK was very much along the lines that Stan and I envisaged when we wrote on this topic, namely that a central bank should have goal dependence and instrument independence and should be held accountable for its decisions through the political process. The subsequent economic performance of the UK economy validates that choice of regime. Whatever failings led to the financial crisis and its long-lived consequences, I am not convinced that central bank independence was a contributing factor. Indeed, I think the experience of the UK economy through the past decade underlines the value of the independence given to it. I do not regard central bank independence as fighting yesterday's war. The theoretical and empirical underpinnings of central bank independence remain as valid today as they did 20 years ago. The links between monetary policy, fiscal policy, and financial stability policy may be more prominent now than they were two decades ago, however. One can question the central bank's understanding of the functioning of the macroeconomy and the transmission process, but that is a separable issue from the validity of independence. That said, the questioning of the framework itself is a vital quid pro quo for independence. The accountability of central banks to the political process and the public more generally is critical. While the combination of goal dependence and instrument independence in terms of monetary policy has stood the test of time, the equivalent in terms of financial stability is much more an open question. Both the goal of financial stability and the instruments are much less clearly defined at present, and I think there needs to be considerably more focus given to that going forward. So, congratulations to the Bank of England on 20 years of independence. It should be very proud of what it has achieved. But it is only 20 not out. The wicket is getting a bit stickier now than it has been. I promise I won't make any too many cricket references here because I know I'm in the ascendancy on that. There are certainly challenges ahead, and some of them are very apparent right now. But I have every expectation that the Bank of England will be able to address those challenges and continue to build a very big score in terms of not-out independence. So let me finish there. Thank you.
We now have an opportunity for questions. I should just put it on the record. I'm rather more optimistic about central bank independence than staying on than Andrew was. And partly, I think his point about trust is relative, so it's not for a very good reason. And it's that if you said to people, do you want to transfer responsibility for setting interest rates from the Bank of England and the Monetary Policy Committee to politicians, I think I know what the answer would be, but we'll see. So, Marcus, please indicate in the usual way. Yes.
If I may pick up on the point Andrew Tarry ended on, which was the danger of groupthink. Guy Debelle argued, I think, the opposite. He said that central bank independence and inflation targeting bore no responsibility for the subsequent crisis. But I think it was true to say this groupthink idea was that they were, the price stability was seen as a guarantee of financial stability. And as evidence in favor of this, I would refer to the adoption of economic models where the financial system was assumed to be perfect, models which in fact completely failed during the crisis. So I think the point made by Andrew Tyrie has to be addressed. I believe it is in fact being addressed by the Bank of England now, because they're trying to look for completely new models. Thank you.
The point I was making was, I think you can separate whether central banks were responsible for the crisis from the framework. And in my, so you can have a misapplication of a framework which is still robust, can cause the problems rather than the framework itself. And I suppose that was the point I was trying to make. It's not obvious to me that central bank independence and inflation targeting per se delivered you a crisis. In a number of countries, including my own, they didn't. So it wasn't the observation, you know, it's true in a number of large Northern Hemisphere countries, but that's not true in all the other number of other economies around the world who have both central bank independence and inflation targeting, which includes myself, my mates across the Tasman, and a number of other Asian countries. None of those countries had a crisis. So I think I would just make the point of separating the framework from the central bank itself, and blame the central bank, not the framework.
Okay, I'm going to try and get as many questions in as possible. Yes.
Yeah, Marion Bell. Just got a question for Guy, following on from his excellent presentation. Do you think there would have been and would in the future be any advantage in central banks and monetary policymakers, perhaps in particular, articulating more strongly, being more vocal in expressing the limitations of the remit? You said clearly that you didn't think that they should expound on other economic policy issues for fear of losing independence, but might it have been beneficial if they had been more clear about the limitations of what they were being asked to do?
Thank you. Who would like to take that?
Remit is given to them by government. Yeah. And it was government who told the central bank that they're now going to be responsible for micro-prue, the Financial Policy Committee. It was government who gave the inflation target. I don't think you can blame central banks for the remit, and the central bankers have always stated very, very clearly that they cannot control things like productivity. I don't think central bankers are hesitant to coming out and saying that there are lots of aspects of economic life which monetary policy cannot touch.
But don't you think there has been a kind of a culture of, I mean, actually, the question about what would people prefer, politicians or what are seen as experts, I think at the moment, in terms of the general environment, politicians and experts are both kind of not in favour, as it were. But I think that one of the dangers of independence, I think, was a sense of outsourcing of political responsibility that, because of everything that's happened in the global economy, has been amplified. And I think there's a very strong point for the Bank of England perhaps speaking more loudly about the limitations of what it is there to do and the remit that it's been given, because I certainly kind of sense, as we've seen with Brexit, where civil servants were being blamed for not having prepared for the outcome, rather than politicians taking responsibility for not instructing them to come up with the impact assessments and action plans to deal with that result. I sense that could be repeated in this area too.
Okay. Good points. Sushi wants to come in. And I can't have all previous members of the MPC, so I'll try and get another one before we get to Martin. Yes, the lady behind you, after Sushi.
What I wanted to ask you, Guy, is that Australia has done remarkably well. You've not had a recession for 27 years. you didn't, your rates didn't have to get to the zero lower bound. Now, obviously, there are many, many factors that have played a role in that. But I wondered if you could just offer your best guess about whether the fact that the last three governors, Ian, Glenn, and now Philip, all have had sympathy for leaning against the wind and have appeared to allow that to play a role in monetary policy has contributed to the success in Australia.
Sorry, I just missed the last bit. What skills did Phil, Glenn and Ian have?
Essentially leaning against the wind.
Ah, okay.
He's asking you to say how wonderful Australia is.
Yeah, well, I was going to say the main reason we've done is something called luck, which if you can have it is always worth having. I'm not so sure it's quite that straightforward, Social, in that I think, again, partly I think luck played a role in containing some of the asset price issues we may or may not have had. I suppose I do think that the macro framework which we had and has been broadly resilient, I think, has been helpful. So at the one point, as I mentioned during the talk, I think I would regard the fact that we've always had a very flexible or pragmatic approach to going about this, I think, has been helpful. So that would be the point I'd emphasise, which means you can take account of things a little more gradually over a longer horizon rather than a sort of very rigid application of the framework, which... And we didn't have a lot of credibility when we started this. As I said, Andy graciously invited us there, but it wasn't to this inflation targeting conference, wasn't entirely clear we deserved our place at the table at the time. With hindsight, we certainly did. But I think that flexibility... which has always been there, I think that's actually probably the most important point, and which has been exemplified in the three governors you talked about, is having that flexibility and that pragmatic approach, which to some extent gets to your point, Francis, about acknowledging the limitations of what you can and can't do, and don't overpromise. And it's not that the central banks necessarily overpromise; it's just the expectation that there's too much expectation, and you've been able to push back on saying, no, actually, there's only so much we can actually do here.
Okay, we're running out of time, so I'm going to get three questions and then throw them all at the panel in different ways. Yes. Yeah.
Puma Kimmis from OMFIF. Thank you very much for that very interesting panel. My question is related to how central bank independence may be linked to geopolitical concerns. What I mean by that is the Bank of England, for example, holds renminbi bonds that I think helped... Make more Chinese money come into the UK, sticky, important institutional money into the UK. Is this a role that central banks can carry on playing to ensure that there is further financial stability with some political support from the Treasury or similar financial institutions? And that was the question. Thank you.
Okay, and then we have the Strictly star, and then we'll have another MPC.
I guess mine's a question to Guy, and it's something which we haven't talked about yet, but actually one of the questions about central bank independence is what impact it has on the Treasury as an institution, as opposed to simply on the central bank. And I think there were three things which we thought it would do. Number one was we thought it would free up a lot more time for the Treasury to focus on lots of other aspects of economic policy, not just fiscal, but broader economic policy, which I think it certainly did, but that's a good thing or a bad thing people can debate. The second thing was that it substantially increased the Treasury's leverage within government in terms of control, because it was much easier to be able to say to the Prime Minister or to other cabinet ministers, well, of course, we'd like to agree to that, but you do realise if we go for X or Y, the consequence could be a rise in interest rates from the Bank of England, and I'm afraid there's nothing we can do about that anymore. The third thing which we thought after the late 1980s, the early 1990s, was that it would lead to less conflicts between the Prime Minister and the Chancellor of the Exchequer. And we got that one wrong.
Martin Wheel, a question perhaps predominantly for Andrew Tyrie. We've heard quite a lot about individual accountability. What role do you or do the panel see for notions of collective responsibility among the committee?
Wonderful point. One thing I would just add to what Ed said there about the impact on the Treasury is, of course, that one of the problems was we made the bank a much more attractive place for economists to work, which made it harder to get them in the Treasury. Andrew, there's one specifically aimed at you there. Do you want to go with that? And then I'll ask all the panel members in question to give us a very, very brief final point, picking up those questions. Collective responsibility?
Yes. I'm also quite interested in what Ed said about the effects on behaviour in Whitehall, which I think's not to be underestimated, having sat through many PESC rounds, public expenditure control rounds, with the chief secretaries. I think there's a lot of strength in that point, rather less in the idea that the Treasury were desperate to find a bit more time to get on with what they should have been getting on with in the beginning. Certainly didn't create less conflict between chancellors and prime ministers, and that seems to... I certainly don't think that's the case. Individual accountability versus collective accountability. OK, well, the MPC works. People didn't think it would work in the way it should, but it has. The transparency that we now enjoy was not there initially, only a proportion of it, and people were very nervous of it, but the very high level of transparency has played a crucial role in delivering that. Now let's have a look at the FPC and see what can be transposed. There are several problems. First of all, quite a lot of the information that the FPC might need derives from confidential sources and will have market effects if it's put in the public domain. Secondly, it's not something that needs necessarily every month or every few months a decision, a specific decision in a thing. It can often be much more discursive than that, particularly if you're trying to deal with groupthink. Nonetheless, I have argued vigorously, and the Treasury Committee argued vigorously, that the FPC could now do more to create a sense of public debate and discourse about aspects of financial stability. Why was I so keen on that, rather than to have these views tucked away behind the scenes in committee? Because of groupthink. Because that is the way to stimulate the public debate, which may lead to less groupthink. Gus wants me to stop. I was going to stop anyway at that point. So over to you, Gus.
No, Francis.
I wanted to pick up on that point about, is there a case for a different relationship between the Treasury and the bank that maybe needs to be codified if we are clearer about roles and responsibilities and the limitations but interplay of each, then is there a way of codifying that relationship in a different way that could be better? And in particular, I liked Ed's point that one of the objectives was to free up the Treasury to get on with the job. And my goodness me, what a job it ought to have at the moment in terms of investment growth and critically to get wages rising again. Because if we're going to have an economy that feels like a success for working people, then we have got to tackle that living standards crisis. And just one last point, Andrew, because I don't think people have forgotten the corrosive impact of inflation. On the contrary, there are 5 million nurses, midwives and other public servants who know that when inflation is running at 2.9 and they're suffering a pay cap of 1%, that has a very corrosive impact on their living standards.
Thanks, Francis. Charles?
We were very fortunate in the first MPC on the subject of groupthink because we had Willem Botha, one of our members. Well, exactly. But to be a bit more serious, Eddie George was very outspoken from the very start that the MPC was to be individualistic, that each of us was to be responsible for our own judgment about what the best way to achieve the government's remit would be, and we had to speak up for ourselves. It's different in different countries and in different conditions. And Otmar Issinger and I and Willem had a sort of various set-tos on this particular subject. I still like the individualistic approach. I think it works. And I think it is particularly a protection against groupthink.
Thank you. Yeah.
I absolutely agree with that. I think the collective responsibility is something that happens in the corporate sector, of course, at boards. And essentially in that environment, the only thing you can do if you disagree is resign. And it would to force you into the nuclear option of someone resigning from the MPC because they couldn't go along with everyone else is a much worse state of affairs than enabling them to give speeches, talk to the select committee, and allow a certain flexibility and even encouragement in differing views. And I just say also in response to the question about the bank and the treasury and should one formalize the responsibilities and the divisions, I think that's possible, but I felt that the system that the U.S. had when Greenspan was there, which, if I remember correctly, it was a Tuesday morning breakfast with Larry Summers at the time and council, I think it was the head of the Council of Economic Advisors as well, completely off the record, but just keeping each other informed and involved in the and able to debate things by themselves without it appeared to be compromising the independence of one side or the other. Quite often, the success of an institution depends on the individuals in the institution and how they behave towards each other. And I think that worked pretty well in the U.S. case.
I suppose I can just give one perspective on Ed's comment, in that in Australia, we have the Secretary of the Treasury is still on our Monetary Policy Committee, has been all the time. And so macro policy making wasn't completely delegated to the central bank, so the Treasury still had to remember how to do macro in Australia. But I think that, and part of that is useful for exactly the point of providing a different perspective. If you've got your two main policy institutions in the country, it's useful that you do have a bit of, not necessarily tension, but at least different perspectives being able to be brought to that. So I get the point about freeing up resources at the Treasury to do other stuff and the benefit of that, but I think there is also some value in having another institution who spends a decent amount of time thinking about macro stuff and being able to provide, possibly, or at least challenge the perspective. But to some extent, the solution here, I think, is exactly the is the MPC with its different with its broad membership from different backgrounds goes some way to doing that here. Though I suppose, and this may raise a slightly touchy point, that always brings up the resourcing of how much resourcing control the MPC independent MPC members have to be able to bring that perspective. So it's not just their perspective, they've got a bit of oomph behind it, otherwise it's somewhat of an unfair contest.
I would just add to what Guy said that trying to do fiscal policy without understanding macro seems to me kind of not really a very good way to do things. So I think the Treasury will always need to understand macro. At that point, I should say thank you very much for all of you. We've overrun slightly, but not as much as Mark did, and I'll be talking to him about keeping prime ministers to time, something I've had to do in my time. So there'll now be a break, and we're due back at 11:45. Yes? Thank you very much for the time.
It is 11:45.